December 22nd, 2015, broadcasting right here on RadioWerewolf.com. I'd like to wish everybody a happy winter solstice out there. Today is the winter solstice, shortest day of the year. That's why I actually played that song. Hopefully the sun comes out more, maybe get a little bit warmer, but it doesn't. It actually gets colder. But that's okay. We haven't had much snow yet, really been that cold yet this winter. So maybe looking forward to some snow for a change. But so tonight what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to discuss the historical aspect of the pagan roots of Christmas, which includes holidays like Saturnalia and Sol Invictus. But also what I'm also going to get into is most of the popular customs of Christmas, which includes Christmas trees, the mistletoe, Christmas presents, Santa Claus, and the modern incarnations of the ancient pagan rituals that most Christians use today that they think is theirs, but it's not. It was actually adopted by Christians long ago. So the first thing I'm going to get into tonight is the actual date. So where did December 25th actually come from? Like, is it really the day Jesus was born? Well, apparently it wasn't. You know, popular myth puts the date of Jesus' birthday on December 25th in the year 1. The New Testament gives no date for the no date or year for Jesus' birth. The earliest Gospel of Mark, written about 65 AD, begins with the baptism of the adult Jesus. This suggests that the early Christians had a lack of knowledge or interest in Jesus' early childhood. The year of Jesus' birth was determined by Dionysius Exiguus, a Scythian monk, abbot of a Roman monastery. And his calculations kind of went like this. In the Roman pre-Christian era, years were counted from the founding of the city of Rome. So 1 AUC would signify the year Rome was founded. So 5 AUC signifies the fifth year of Rome's reign, etc., etc. So Dionysius received a tradition that the Roman Emperor Augustus reigned for 43 years and was followed by Emperor Tiberius. In Luke 3:1-23 indicates that when Jesus turned 30, it was the 15th year of Tiberius' reign. Now, if Jesus was 30 years old in Tiberius' reign, then he lived 15 years under Augustus, placing Jesus' birth in Augustus' 28th year of reign. I know this is kind of confusing, but it makes sense. Augustus took power in 727 AUC. Therefore, Dionysius put Jesus' birth at 554 AUC. However, Luke 1:5 places Jesus' birth in the days of Herod. And Herod died in 750 AUC. So 4 years before the year in which Dionysius said that Jesus' birth took place. So Christians would actually be reassured to learn that the date of Christmas may derive from the concept in Judaism that linked the time of the death of the prophet was actually linked to their conception or their birth. So from this, earlier classical number crunchers extrapolated that the 9 months of Mary's pregnancy following conception, which would actually be taking place on March 25th, would produce a December 25th date for the birth of Christ. However, there's a problem with that also, because that would bring up the problem that Easter does not fall on the fixed date of March 25th, but follows the pagan tradition of the lunar calendar. But that's an entirely different discussion for another time as to why Christians would use a lunar calendar for a holiday. Joseph A. Fischmeyer, a professor of biblical studies at the Catholic University of America, writing in the Catholic Church's official commentary on the New Testament, writes about the date of Jesus' birth. Quote, through the year of Jesus' birth is not reckoned with certainty. The birth did not occur in AD 1. The Christian era supposed to have its starting point in the year of Jesus' birth is based on a miscalculation introduced in 533 by Dionysius Exiguus. The De Pascha Computus, an anonymous document believed to have been written in North Africa around 243, placed Jesus' birth at March 28th. Clement, a bishop of Alexandria, thought Jesus was born on November 18th. Based on historical records, Fritzmeyer suggests that the birth of Jesus occurred on, get this, September 11th, 3 BC. So, in all actuality, even goddamn biblical scholars can't agree on what day Jesus was born. Then that leads to another question. How exactly did Christmas become celebrated on December 25th? So then, if we go back to the Roman days, Roman pagans first introduced the holiday of Saturnalia, a week-long period of lawlessness celebrated between December 17th and December 25th. During the period, Roman courts was closed. The Roman law dictated that no one could be punished for damaging property or injuring people during this week-long celebration. It was a public holiday celebrated around December 25th in the family home. It was a time for feasting, goodwill, generosity to the poor, the exchanging of gifts, the decoration of trees, but it still wasn't Christmas. It was Saturnalia, the pagan Roman winter solstice festival. The first century AD poet Gaius Valerius Catullus described Saturnalia as the best of times. Dress codes were relaxed, small gifts such as dolls, candles, and caged birds were exchanged. Saturnalia saw the inversion of social roles. The wealthy were expected to pay the month's rents of those who couldn't afford it. Slaves and masters would swap clothes. Family households threw dice to determine who would become the temporary monarch of the family. The poet Lucian of Samosata has the god Cronus in a poem saying that during my week, the Sirius is barred, no business allowed, drinking and being drunk, noise and games of dice, appointing kings and feasting of slaves, singing naked, clapping, and occasionally dunking a corked faces in icy water. Such are the functions over which I preside. Saturnalia originated as a farmer's festival to mark the end of the autumn planting season in honor of Saturn. Numerous archaeological sites from the Roman coastal province of Constantine demonstrate that the cult of Saturn survived there until the early century AD. Saturnalia grew in duration and moved to progressively later dates under the Roman period. During the reign of Emperor Augustus, it was a two-day affair starting on December 17th. By the time Lucian described the festivities, it was a seven-day event. Changes to the Roman calendar moved the climax of Saturnalia to December 25th, around the time of the date of the winter solstice. From as early as 1217 BC, there were public Saturnalia banquets. States canceled executions and refrained from declaring war during these festivals. Pagan Roman authorities tried to curtail Saturnalia. In fact, Emperor Caligula, of all people, sought to restrict it to only 5 days, but had little success. So the conversion of the Emperor Constantine to Christianity in 312 AD ended Roman persecutions of Christians and began imperial patronage of the Christian churches. But Christianity did not become a widespread religion of the Roman Empire overnight. Dr. David Gwynn, lecturer in ancient and late history at Royal Holloway, University of London, says that alongside Christian and other pagan festivals, that Saturnalia continued to be celebrated for centuries afterwards. Christmas apparently started, like Saturnalia, in Rome and spread to the Eastern Mediterranean. The earliest known reference is that It commemorated the birth of Christ on December 25th, is in the Roman calendar of 354. Provincial schisms soon resulted in different Christian calendars. The Orthodox Church in eastern half of the Roman Empire fixed the date of Christmas at January 6th, commemorating simultaneously Christ's birth, baptism, and first miracle. Saturnalia has a rival contender as a forerunner of Christmas, which is the festival of Dies Natalis Solis Invicticus, or the birthday of the unconquered sun, which also is slated for December 25th, which was a Roman civil holiday honoring the cult of Sol Invictica. The Romans held the festival on December 25th, so the use of the title Sol Invicticus allowed several solar deities to be worshipped collectively, including Allah Gabal, which was a Syrian sun god, Sol, the patron god of the emperor, and Mitharas, the soldier's god of Persian origin. So the emperor, Allah Gabalus, introduced the festival, and it reached the height of its popularity under Aurelian, who promoted it as an empire-wide holiday and effectively made it a state religion, which in fact they actually made coins to commemorate it. Sol Invicta succeeded because of its ability to assimilate aspects of Jupiter and other deities into the figure of the Sun King, reflecting the absolute power of the divine emperors. But despite efforts by later pagan emperors to control Saturnalia and absorb the festival into the official religion, Sol Invicta ended up very much like the old Saturnalia. Constantine, the first Christian emperor, was brought up under Sol Invicta in what was already a pretty much predominantly monotheist empire. It is therefore possible, says Dr. Gwynn, that Christmas was intended to replace the festival rather than Saturnalia. So Gwynn concludes, the majority of the modern scholars would be reluctant to accept any close connection between Saturnalia and the emergence of the Christian Christmas. So Christians actually had little success, however, refining the practices of Saturnalia. As Stefan Nestenbaum, professor of history of the University of Massachusetts, writes, in return for ensuring massive observance of the anniversary of the Savior's birth by assigning it to its date, the church, for its part, tactfully agreed to allow the holiday to be celebrated more or less the way it's always been. The earliest Christmas holidays were celebrated by drinking, sexual indulgence, singing naked in the streets, etc. The Reverend Increase Mather of Boston observed in 1687 that the early Christians who were first observed the Nativity on December 25th did not do so thinking that Christ was born in that month, but because the heathens, Saturnalia, was at the time kept in Rome, and that they were willing to have those pagan holidays metamorphosized into Christian ones. Because of its known pagan origin, Christmas was actually banned by the Puritans, and its observance was illegal in Massachusetts between 1659 and 1681. However, Christmas was and still is, celebrated by most Christians around the world. But there are still some Christians that don't celebrate it because it is a pagan holiday. So some of the customs of Saturnalia were intentionally received by the Catholic Church in 1466 when Pope Paul II, for his amusement of his Roman citizens, forced Jews to run naked through the streets, and eyewitness reports before they were to run, the Jews were richly fed as to make it more difficult to run for them, and at the same time, more amusing for the spectators. They ran, amid Rome's taunting shrieks and peals of laughter, while the Holy Father stood upon his richly adorned balcony and laughed heartily. So that's where the date December 25th actually comes from. Christians took the holiday of Rome and made it their own. So now we know where the date comes from. Now we can look at some of the other customs. Like, for instance, where did a Christmas tree come from? So just as early Christians recruited Roman pagans by associating Christmas with Saturnalia, so too worshippers of Asherah and its offshoots were recruited by the Christian church sanctioning quote-unquote Christmas trees. Pagans had long worshipped trees in the forest or brought them into their homes and decorated them, and this observance was adopted and painted with a Christian veneer by the church. So many pagan cultures used to bring cuts of evergreen trees in December and move them into their home or temple and decorate them, which modern-day pagans still do. This was recognized during the winter solstice, the time of year that the shortest daylight hours and the longest night of the year. As the solstice approached, they noticed that the days were gradually getting shorter. They feared that the sun would eventually disappear forever, and everyone would freeze in the dark and starve to death because of the failure of the next year's crop. So even though trees, bushes, and crops died and hibernated for the winter, the evergreen trees remained green. They seemed to have magical powers that enabled them to withstand the rigors of winter. Now, not having evergreen trees, the ancient Egyptians considered the palm tree to symbolize resurrection. They decorated their homes with the branches during the winter solstice. The first decorating evergreen tree began with the Greeks and their worship of the god Adonia, who allegedly was brought back to life by a serpent after having been slain. The ancient Romans decorated their trees with bits of metal and replicas of their god Bacchus. They also placed 12 candles on the trees in honor of their sun god. Their midwinter festival of Saturnalia started on December 17th and often lasted until a few days after the solstice. In Northern Europe, the ancient Germanic people tied fruit and attached candles to evergreen tree branches in honor of their god Woden. Trees were viewed as symbolizing eternal life. The trees joined holly, mistletoe, the wassail bowl, and the yule log as symbols of the season, all of which, of course, predates Christianity. One Christian tradition was that Saint Boniface cut down a deciduous tree in the presence of some newly baptized Christians. The tree was an oak, one that was actually sacred to the former pagans. It miraculously split into four pieces, revealing an evergreen tree growing from the center of the oak stump. This was interpreted as symbolizing the death of paganism and the establishment of Christianity. Another is that Martin Luther, who was so impressed by the forest scene that he allegedly cut down a small fern tree, took it home, and decorated it with lighted candles. This may actually be a myth, because the earliest documented record of a Christmas tree in Germany is dated almost 60 years after Martin Luther's death. The modern Christmas tree dates back to Western Germany in the 16th century. They were actually brought into the home to celebrate the annual feast of Adam and Eve on December 24th. They were first brought to America by German immigrants in about the year 1700. Christmas trees became popular among the general U.S. population about 1850 and have remained so ever since. President Franklin Pierce arranged to have the first Christmas tree brought to the White House during the mid-1950s. Calvin Coolidge started the National Christmas Tree Lighting Ceremony at the White House lawn in 1923. And is now replaced by a giant fucking menorah, but you can't say who goddamn controls America, even though there's a giant fucking menorah in front of the White House. But apparently they're only 2% of the population, so that doesn't matter. So in the past, there has been many objections to Christmas trees. As weird as that sounds. We are talking about Christians here, though. So the prophet Jeremiah condemned as a pagan the Middle Eastern practice of cutting down trees and bringing them into the home and decorating them. Apparently, in Jeremiah's time, the heathen would cut down the trees, carve or decorate them in the form of a god or goddess, and overlay them with precious metals. Some Christians currently feel that this pagan practice was similar enough to our present use of Christmas trees that this passage from Jeremiah can be used to condemn both. However, Hank Hanegraaff of the Christian Research Institute commented that Christmas season, as in those gone by, is the commonplace to hear Christians condemn trees adorned with ornaments as idolatrous. The following passage from Jeremiah is often cited as a support for the condemnation. So in Jeremiah 10, 2 through 4, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the sign of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth the tree of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers, that it will not move. Now Jeremiah's description of a tree cut in the forest and adorned with silver and gold and fasten it with a hammer and nails so it would not move, therefore, is a reference actually to wooden idols and not a Christmas tree. And also, the English Puritans condemned a number of customs associated with Christmas, such as the use of the Yule log, holly, mistletoe, etc. Oliver Cromwell preached against the heathen traditions of Christmas carols, decorating trees and any joyful expression that desecrated the sacred event. In America, the Pilgrims' second governor, William Bradford, a Calvinist, tried hard to stamp out all, quote, pagan mockery, unquote, at Christmas time. Christmas trees were not generally used by Puritans in colonial times. However, if they were, they would have certainly been forbidden. In 1851, Pastor Henry Schwann of Cleveland, Ohio, appears to have been the person responsible for decorating the first Christmas tree in an American church. His parishioners condemned the idea as a pagan practice, or some even threatened the pastor with actual violence, but soon objections would be dissipated. So actually, I think I'm going to take a quick break here. I got a couple things I'm going to play for you guys. I'll actually play this song. This is Emerald Rose. This is called Santa Claus is Pagan Too.
Oh, Santa Claus is pagan too, just like all the rest. And if you are a merry witch, he'll bring you all the best. So get that star up on the roof and bake those cookies too. Cause Christmas time is really Yule, and Santa's pagan too. He's got that Buddha belly, and his top's the Holly King. You dressed him in that British coat, the cap's the Nordic thing. You took the horns right off his head and stuck them on his deer. But he still flies high like Jupiter with a belly full of beer. Hey, Santa Claus is pagan too, just like all the rest. And if you are a merry witch, he'll bring you all the best. So get that star up on the roof and make those cookies too. Cause Christmas time is really Yule and Santa's pagan too. Now history says Christ was likely not a Capricorn. But if you wanna share our Yule, we don't care when he's born. Come celebrate the dawning of the Sun King's bright rebirth. And if you practice what you preach, we'll all have peace on earth. Hey, Santa Claus is pagan too, just like all the rest. And if you are a merry witch, he'll bring you all the best. So get that star up on the roof and make those cookies too. Cause Christmas time is really Yule, and Santa's pagan too. Now, Santa's way more jolly than most Christians would require, and if he weren't so busy, he'd be dancing around this fire. Yeah, you can call it Christmas, you got a way outgun, but just you wait till Beltane, then we'll see who's having fun.
Hey!
Santa Claus is pagan too, just like all the rest, and if you are a merry witch, he'll bring you all the best. So get that star upon the roof and bake those cookies too, 'cause Christmas time is really Yule, and Santa's pagan too.
Hey!
Santa Claus is pagan too, just like all the rest, and if you are a merry witch, he'll bring you all the best. So get that star upon the roof and bake those cookies too, 'cause Christmas time is really Yule, and Santa's pagan too.
Actually, I always liked that song. So welcome back to Radio Werewolf, right here on RadioWerewolf.com. So now we're going to get into the mistletoe. So from the earliest times, the mistletoe has been one of the most magical, mysterious, and sacred plants of European folklore. It was considered to bestow life and fertility and protection against poison, and it was also known as an aphrodisiac. The mistletoe of the sacred oak was especially sacred to the ancient Celtic druids. On the sixth night of the moon, white-robed druid priests would cut the oak mistletoe with a golden sickle. Two white bulls would be sacrificed amid prayers that the recipients of the mistletoe would prosper. Later, the ritual of cutting the mistletoe from the oak came to symbolize the emasculation of the old king by his successor. Mistletoe was long regarded as both a sexual symbol and the soul of the oak. It was gathered at both midsummer and winter solstices, and the custom of using mistletoe to decorate houses at Christmas is a survival of the Druid and other pre-Christian traditions. The Greeks also thought that it had mystical powers, and down through the centuries, it became associated with many folklore customs. And in the Middle Ages and later, branches of the mistletoe were hung from ceilings to ward off evil spirits. In Europe, they were placed over house and stable doors to prevent the entrance of witches. It was also believed that the oak mistletoe could extinguish fire. It was associated with an earlier belief that the mistletoe itself would come to the tree during a flash of lightning. Or the traditions, which began with the European mistletoe, were transferred to the similar American plant with the process of immigration and settlement of the European peoples to the United States. Kissing under the mistletoe was first found associated with the festival of Saturnalia and later with marriage rites. They probably originated from two beliefs. One belief was that it has a power to just bestow fertility. It was also believed that the dung from which the mistletoe would be found would also possess life-giving power. In Scandinavia, mistletoe was considered a plant of peace under which enemies could declare a truce, warring spouses kiss and make up later. Later in the 18th century, English credited with a certain magical appeal called a kissing ball. So at Christmas time, a young lady standing under a ball of mistletoe, brightly trimmed with evergreens, ribbons, and ornaments, cannot refuse to be kissed. Such a kiss would mean a deep romance or lasting friendship and goodwill. If the girl remained unkissed, she cannot expect to marry for the following year. In some parts of England, the Christmas mistletoe is burned on the 12th night, lest all the boys and girls who have kissed under it may never marry. Whether we believe it or not, it is still fun and a tradition that still holds today. Even if the pagan significance has long been forgotten, the custom of exchanging a kiss under the mistletoe can still be found in many European countries, as well as in Canada. Thus, if a couple in love exchanges a kiss under the mistletoe. It is interpreted as a promise to marry, as well as a prediction of happiness and a long life. In France, the custom is linked to mistletoe, but it's actually reserved for New Year's Day. For its mystical powers, mistletoe has long been the center of many folklore. One in association with the goddess Frigga, the story comes that the mistletoe was the sacred plant of Frigga, the goddess of love and the mother of Baldur, the god of the summer sun. Baldur had a dream of death which greatly alarmed his mother, for should he die, all life on earth would end. In an attempt to keep this from happening, Frigga went at once to air, fire, water, and earth, and every animal and plant, seeking a promise that no harm would come to her son. Baldur now could not be hurt by anything on earth or under the earth. But Baldur had one enemy, Loki, and he knew the one plant that Frigga had overlooked in her quest to keep her son safe. It grew neither on the earth nor under the earth, but on apple and oak trees. It was the lowly mistletoe. So Loki made an arrow tip of mistletoe and gave it to the blind god of winter, Hodur, who shot it, striking Baldur dead. The sky paled, and all things in the earth and heaven wept for the sun god. For 3 days, each element tried to bring Baldur back to life. He was finally restored by Frigga, the goddess, and his mother. It is said that the tears she shed for her son turned into a pearly white berries that appear on the mistletoe plant, and in her joy, Frigga kissed everyone who passed beneath the tree on which it grew. Now, the story ends with a decree that who should ever stand under the humble mistletoe, no harm shall fall upon them, only a kiss and a token of love. All right, so then we go to the next custom. I'm not really good with segues here. So the first one we have is Christmas ham. Damn ham. I'm not a big fan of ham. Ham's okay, I guess. Now I eat like a couple times a year. Maybe Christmas and Easter. That's pretty much it. I'm going to eat so much goddamn ham this weekend, I'm going to be sick of this crap. So on December 17th, a day that was actually known as Sow's Day, every family would keep swine, would slaughter a sow for Yule. Right in between 1791 and 1799, the author of the old statistical account states that there's no tradition as to the origin of this practice. He concluded that it could therefore have no significance other than the fact that it provided meat for the Yule feast. However, it is far too coincidental that this slaughter was part of Yule, especially considering the connections between the pig, or more specifically the boar, and the Yuletide traditions found across Northern Europe. Pork is a traditional Yule dish in Norway, probably a reminder of the time when the boar, an animal sacred to Freya, the Norse god of Yule and fertility, was sacrificed at Yule, and his flesh was eaten as part of the feast. Being this sacred animal, the boar has always had a strong association with Yule and represented the spirits of abundance and prosperity. Its sacrifice at the darkest time of the year was thought to have helped to ensure bountiful crops the following harvest. And it's also possible that the boar would actually represent the sun. In Scandinavian myths, Freyr possessed a magical boar, a magical golden boar. This creature was able to run as fast as any steed and glowed with a golden light that could drive away shadow and turn night into day. The solar attributes of this incredible beast, created by the dwarfs Brock and a tree, are clear, except for my pronunciation of the goddamn word. In midwinter sacrifice of the boar could also be seen to symbolize the death of the old sun and rebirth of the new. The boar also had a role in the swearing of sacred oaths. On Yule Eve, the best boar in the herd was brought to the hall, where the assembly the assembled company laid their hands upon the animal and made their unbreakable oaths. Heard by the boar, these oaths would be thought to go straight to the ears of Freyr himself. Once the oaths had been sworn, the boar was sacrificed, and the feast of the boar began. So the most commonly recognized remembrance of the sacred boar traditions, once common at Yule, was also to serve the head of the boar at later Christmas feasts. This was actually popular in England. I don't know why you want to serve a pig head at a feast, but that's apparently what they did. So that's where the idea of why we have ham every Christmas. It's been passed down through the centuries from our European ancestors. All right. So now we go to the origins of Christmas presents. So the origins of Christmas presents is actually from pre-Christian Rome. The emperors compelled their most despised citizens to bring offerings and gifts during the Saturnalia festival. Later, this ritual expanded to include gift-giving among the general populace. The Christian church gave this custom a Christian flavor by rerouting it in the gift-giving of St. Nicholas. The heathen custom was rationalized into Christianity by associated with the gifts of a magi described in Matthew 2, and then with the story of St. Nicholas. And of course, St. Nicholas came to be the origin of the person known as Santa Claus, which we will get to in just a little bit. For a couple centuries, gift-giving was actually banned, mostly by the Puritans, but gift-giving was a custom that was actually revived in the Victorian age. It was an era where it was a strong interest in reviving old customs, but as the popularity of Christmas grew, it was displaced by New Year's. Prince Albert called Christmas a day of exchanging presents as marks of mutual affection and goodwill. And actually, one thing that's interesting, a lot of these traditions did die out during like the Middle Ages, but they were actually revived by the Victorian age, like the boar's head thing and Yule logs and gift giving, and that's all I can think of off the top of my head. But yeah, Victorian England did revive a lot of these traditions from the ancient pagans, and of course brought them to the New World. At the same time, a lot of Germans held on to these beliefs. So the next thing, since we're talking about Christmas, we can talk about who brings the Christmas presents. The modern Santa Claus is derived from the British figure of Father Christmas, the Dutch figure Sinterklaas, and of course St. Nicholas, the historical Greek bishop and gift giver of Myra. During the Christianization of Germanic Europe, this figure may have also absorbed elements of the god Odin, who was associated with the Germanic pagan midwinter event of Yule, and actually led the Great Hunt, or the Wild Hunt. So the story of Santa Claus begins with Nicholas, who was born during the 3rd century in a village of Patara in 270. At the time, the area was Greek and is now the southern coast of Turkey. His wealthy parents, who raised him to be a devout Christian, died in an epidemic where Nicholas was still young. So obeying Jesus' word to sell what you own and give money to the poor, Nicholas used his whole inheritance to assist the needy, the sick, and the suffering. He dedicated his life to serving God and was actually made a bishop of Myra while still a young man. He was never even a priest. They just automatically made him a bishop. Maybe he bought that too, I don't know. It is plausible. So Bishop Nicholas became known throughout the land for his generosity to those in need, his love for children, and his concern for sailors and ships. So under the Roman Emperor Diocletian, who ruthlessly persecuted Christians, Bishop Nicholas suffered for his faith, was exiled and imprisoned. The prisons were so full of bishops, priests, and deacons at the time, they had no rooms for actual criminals, like, I don't know, murderers and robbers. So after his release, Nicholas attended the Council of Nicaea. The text they, here's a little interesting side note. So the text that they actually produced was the first time that the Jews were pretty much called out as the children of the devil, who sentenced Jesus to death. That was the first time Jews were blamed for killing Jesus. And they also prohibited usury. That was also a first. The most famous story about St. Nicholas tells us how the custom of hanging up stockings, receive gifts, came about. There was a poor man who had three daughters. He was so poor that he did not have enough money for a dowry. So his daughters couldn't get married. So a dowry is actually a sum of money paid to a bridegroom by the bride's parents on the wedding day. This still happens in some countries even today. So one night, Nicholas secretly dropped a bag of gold down the chimney and into the house. The bag fell into a stocking that had been hung by the fire to dry. This was repeated later with the second daughter, and finally determined to discover the person who was giving him money, the father secretly hid by the fire every evening until he caught Nicholas dropping in the bag of gold. Nicholas begged for the man not to tell anyone what he had done, because he did not want to bring attention to himself. But soon the news got around, and when everyone received a secret gift, it was automatically thought that it was from Nicholas. So he died on December 6, 343, in Myra, and was buried in a cathedral church where a unique relic called manna formed in his grave. This liquid substance, said to have had healing powers, fostered the growth of devotion to Nicholas. The anniversary of his death became the day of celebration, which we still actually celebrate today, which is St. Nicholas Day, on December 6th. In 1087, a group of sailors who idolized Nicholas moved his bones from Turkey to a sanctuary in Bari, Italy. There, Nicholas supplanted a female boon-giving deity called the Grandmother, who used to fill the children's stockings with her gifts. The grandmother was ousted from her shrine at Bari, which became the center of the Nicholas cult. Members of the group gave each other gifts during a pageant they conducted annually on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which is, again, December 6th. So the remains of the Greek bishop, who lived in the 3rd and 4th century, are housed in Bari, Italy. When the crypt of Biscala San Nicola were repaired in the 1950s, the saint's skull and bones were documented by x-ray photos and thousands of detailed measurements. Carolyn Wilkinson, a facial anthropologist at the University of Manchester in England, used this data and modern software simulations to create a modern reconstruction of the long-dead man. Wilkinson put a human face on Santa's original namesake, one with a badly broken nose, possibly suffered during the persecution of the Christians. Much of her work is necessary subject to interpretation. The size and shape of the muscle features, which once covered Nicholas's skull, had to be inferred, and the shape of that skull was recreated from a two-dimensional data. A digital artist added details that are best based on guesses, including the olive-toed skin, most common among Greek Mediterraneans like Nicholas, brown eyes, and the gray hairs of a 60-year-old man. We were bound to have lost some of the level of detail you would get by working from photographs, but we believe that this is the closest we'll ever get to actually seeing him, Wilkinson said in the BBC Two feature film of the project entitled The Real Face of Santa. This is what people do with your goddamn tax money. But I guess there are worse things, like funding Israel. So how did this St. Nicholas become a North Pole-dwelling bringer of Christmas gifts? The original Santa was a Greek born 28 years after, or 280 years after Christ, who had become the Bishop of Myra, a small Roman town in Turkey. Nicholas was neither fat nor jolly, but developed a reputation as a fiery, wiry, and defiant defender of church doctrine during the quote-unquote Great Persecution, when Bibles were put to the torch and priests were made to renounce Christianity or face execution. Nicholas denied these edicts and spent years in prison before Constantine brought Christianity to prominence in his empire. Nicholas's fame lived long after his death because he was associated with many miracles, and reverence for him continues to this day, independent of his Santa Claus connection. Nicholas rose to prominence among the saints because he was the patron of so many groups, ranging from sailors to entire nations. By about 1200, explained University of Manitoba historian Jerry Bowler, author of Santa Claus, a Biography. There's another guy who needs a real job. He became known as a patron of children and magical gift bringer because of the two great stories from his life. All right. Yeah, the better known tales, the three girls are saved from a... Oh, that's why I kept that in there, because it's a little bit different than the story I read before. So instead of the three girls who needed money to get married because their father was too poor for a dowry, in this better known tale, three girls are saved from a life of prostitution when a young Bishop Nicholas secretly delivered bags of gold to their indebted father. There's a difference there. So the other story is not so well known, but was enormously well known in the Middle Ages. Bowler said, Nicholas entered an inn whose keeper had just murdered three boys and pickled their dismembered bodies in basement barrels. The bishop not only sensed the crime, but resurrected the victims as well. That's one of the things that made him the patron saint of children. The Nicholas concept spread through the north until it was adopted by German and Celtic pagans. These groups worship a pantheon led by Woden. Woden had a long white beard and rode a horse through the heavens on an evening each autumn. When Nicholas merged with Woden, he shed his medieval his Mediterranean appearance, grew a beard, mounted a flying horse, rescheduled his flight for December, and donned heavy clothing. In a bid for pagan adherence in Northern Europe, the Catholic Church adopted Nicholas and taught that he did distribute gifts on December 25th instead of December 6th. For several hundred years, from about 1200 to 1500, St. Nicholas was the unchallenged gift bringer, and the toast of celebration centered around this day of December 6th. The strict saint took on some aspects of earlier European deities like the Roman Saturn or the Norse Odin. After the Protestant Reformation, saints like Nicholas fell out of favor across much of Europe, which was pretty problematic, Bowler said. You still love your kids, but now who's going to bring them the gifts? Bowler said that in many cases, the job fell to the baby Jesus, and the date was moved to Christmas rather than December 6th. But the infant's carrying capacity is very limited, and he's not very scary either, Bowler said. So the Christ child was often given a scary helper to do the lugging of the presents and the threatening of kids that doesn't seem appropriate coming from the baby Jesus. Baby Jesus. Some of these scary dramatic figures, again, were based on Nicholas. No longer a saint, but as a threatening sidekick like Ruklaus, Ashen cloths and pens of nickel. These figures expected good behavior or forced children to suffer consequences like raping or kidnapping. Dissimilar as they seem to the Jolly Man in Red, these colorful characters would later figure into the development of Santa himself. So in the Netherlands, kids and families simply refused to give up St. Nicholas as a gift bringer, and they brought out Sinterklaas and his enduring name to them to the New World colonies, where the legend of the shaggy and scary Germanic gift bringers also endured. But in the early American Christmas, wasn't much like the modern holiday. The holiday was shunned in New England, and elsewhere it had become a bit of a pagan Saturnalia that once occupied its place on the calendar. It was celebrated as a kind of outdoor, alcohol-fueled, rowdy community blowout, Boulder said. That's what it had become in England as well, and there was no particular magical gift bringer. And then during the early decades of the 19th century, all that changed thanks to several poets and writers who strove to make Christmas more of a family-friendly celebration by reviving and remaking St. Nicholas. In 1809, the novelist Washington Irving, who is most famous for The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle, wrote a satire of Dutch culture entitled Knickerbocker History of New York. The satire refers several times to the white-bearded, flying horse-riding, pipe-smoking St. Nicholas under his Dutch name, Santa Claus. In 1821, an anonymous illustrated poem titled The Children's Friend went much further in shaping the modern Santa and associated him with Christmas. Here we finally see the appearance of Santa Claus, Bowler said. They've taken the magical gift bringings of St. Nicholas, stripped him of any religious characteristics, and dressed this Santa in furs of those shaggy Germanic gift bringers. That figure brought gifts to good girls and boys, but he also sported a birch rod. The poem noted that directs a parent's hand to use when virtue's paths his sons refuse. Santa's thin wagon was pulled by a single reindeer, but both driver and team would make up a major makeover the following year. In 1822, Clement Clark Moore wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas, which is more commonly known today as It Was the Night Before Christmas, for his six children, with no intention of adding to the fledgling Santa Claus phenomenon. It was published anonymously the next year, and to this day, the plump, jolly Santa described therein rides a sleigh driven by eight reindeer. It went viral, Bowler said, but familiar as the poem is, it still leaves much to the imagination. And the 19th century saw Santa appear in a different colored clothing, in different sizes from miniature to massive, and in a variety of different guises. I have a wonderful picture of him that looks exactly like George Washington riding a broomstick, Bowler said. I'd actually like to see that. It wasn't until the late 19th century, he added, that the image of Santa became standardized as a full adult dressed in red with white fur trim, venturing from the North Pole in his reindeer-driven sleigh and keeping an eye on children's behavior. The jolly, chubby, grandfatherly face of this Santa was largely created by Thomas Nast, the great political cartoonist in the era that featured Minnie. However, Nast did leave him half-sized, Bowler added, and then what I think was rather indecent long johns. Which actually, that reminds me, when I was a kid, you seen all those cartoons from What is that? I think it's like Mickey Mouse and stuff, like the really old ones from like the 30s and stuff. Everybody's wearing those long johns with the butt flap. And the butt flap always comes undone. They're all walking around with their butts hanging out. I think that's what he's talking about. So the Bavarian illustrator, Thomas Nast, almost completed the modern picture of Santa Claus. From 1862 to 1886, based on Moore's poem, Nast drew more than 2,200 cartoon images of Santa's, or of Santa, for Harper's Weekly. Before Nast, St. Nicholas had been pictured as everything from a stern-looking bishop to a gnome-looking, a gnome-like figure in a frock. Nast also gives Santa a home at the North Pole, his workshop filled with elves, and his list of good and bad children of the world. Now, all Santa was missing was his red outfit. So once firmly established, North America's Santa then underwent a kind of reversed migration back to Europe, replacing the scary gift givers and adopted local names like Père Noël and Father Christmas. What he's done is pretty much tame these grim fairy tale type characters from the late medieval days, Bowler said. In 1931, Coca-Cola Corporation contacted the Swedish commercial artist Hedin Sundblom, Sandblom, to create a Coke-inspired Santa. Sandblom modeled his Santa on his friend, chosen for his cheerful, chubby face. The corporation insisted that Santa's fur-trimmed suit might be colored Coca-Cola red. And Santa was born a blend of Christian crusader, pagan god, and commercial idol. Though he undoubtedly means well, Santa has certainly stirred up and continues to create more than his fair share of controversy. In Russia, Santa Claus fell afoul of Joseph Stalin. Before the Russian Revolution, Grandfather Frost was a favored figure of Christmas who had adopted characteristics of the proto-Santa, much like the Dutch Sinterklaas. When the Soviet Union was formed, the communists abolished the celebration of Christmas and gift-giving. Fucking commies. And then in the 1930s, when Stalin needed to build support, he allowed the reemergence of the Grandfather Frost, not as a Christmas gift bringer, but as a New Year's gift bringer. Attempts to displace Christmas in Russia were ultimately unsuccessful, as the Soviets' attempts to spread a secular version of Grandfather Frost, complete with a blue coat to avoid Santa confusion across Europe. So Santa remained a politicalized figure around the world. American troops spread their version of the Jolly Man throughout the world immediately in the years following World War II, and he was generally welcomed, Bowler said, as a symbol of American generosity, like blowing up your fucking country. Nowadays, however, people in many nations have Santa on their own naughty list, either because he represents the commercialization of Christmas at the expense of Christ, or simply because he's not local. In places like the Czech Republic, the Netherlands, Austria, and Latin America, they have a long-standing anti-Santa movement because they're trying to preserve their native Christmas gift-bringing and customs, and to protect them from the North American Santa, which I do not blame these people at all. And that's one of the major problems we have nowadays, is the commercialization of every goddamn thing, especially Christmas. So, before I get to the next part, which is the part I really wanted to get to the whole goddamn time, so here's a little song from, Rusty Cage, called Krumpus is Coming to Town.
Oh, hey, kids. Uncle Rusty here. You know, it seems to me that people have forgotten what the holiday spirits are all about. So I'm going to sing a little song for you about the true meaning of Christmas. I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, Christmas time is magical. At least that's what I'm told. To buy each other useless presents wherever they are sold. When spoiled snot-nosed brats can cry, when mom and dad forget to buy them all the things they want under the Christmas tree. So visit home this winter season. Heaven knows you need a reason to talk to your annoying family. So have yourself a merry little Christmas holiday and celebrate when Jesus Christ was born. Though Santa isn't real, beware of stories never told when Krampus comes to rip apart your soul. Let's not forget our pagan roots of Krampus and his cloven hooves. This hellish demon sneaks into your home. He'll eat your heart and drink your blood, no matter if you're bad or good, and rip your skull out and place upon his throne. Oh, Krampus, but don't let these stories get you, though your parents can't protect you. Krampus eats the flesh of adults too. So dream your dreams of sugar plums. What the fuck is a sugar plum? Christmas is a time for me and you. So have yourself a merry little Christmas holiday and celebrate when Jesus Christ was born. Though Santa isn't real, beware of stories never told when Krampus comes to rip apart your soul. Oh, Krampus, please don't eat my heart. Oh, Krampus, please don't eat my soul. Oh, Krampus, please don't eat my flesh. Oh, Krampus, please don't eat my parents. So have yourself a merry little Christmas holiday and celebrate when Jesus Christ was born. Though Santa isn't real, beware of stories never told when Krampus comes to rip apart your 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 Santa comes to bring you lots of joy.
Merry Christmas, everyone, and to all, a good night.
All right, welcome back to Radio Werewolf. I'm your host for tonight, Dion. Now we're going to get to the best part. So, Christmas has not always been all happy and jolly. There's some other more fiendish characters that have been associated with the holiday. So now we're going to get into the 8 legendary monsters of Christmas. So the customs of the Christmas holiday, which includes Santa and New Year's Day, as well as Christmas, often incorporated earlier pagan traditions that have been appropriated, cultural appropriation by a fucking dead Jew, and adopted for contemporary use. Customs that encourage little children to be good, so they deserve their Christmas gifts, often come with a dark side. The punishment you'll receive from these monsters or evil beings of some sort if you're not good. So these nefarious characters vary from place to place, and they go by different names and different images. So the first one I want to talk about is Krampus. He's probably the most well-known. Actually, it was funny when I was doing research into this show. I was looking on YouTube and stuff like that. There's actually some pretty crappy B movies made about Krampus, but there's one I actually do want to see just because I know it's going to be so bad. It's going to be hilarious. I think this movie is called Krampus versus Santa Claus, and there's a pretty sweet fight scene at the end. So as a tool to encourage good behavior in children, Santa serves as the carrot and Krampus is the stick. Krampus is an evil demon anti-Santa, or maybe his evil twin. He's a half-goat, half-demon, horrific beast who literally beats people into being nice and not naughty. Krampusnacht is celebrated on December 5th, the eve of St. Nicholas Day in Austria and other parts of Europe. Krampus, whose name is derived from the word Krampen, meaning claw, is said to be the son of hell in Norse mythology. The legendary beast also shares characteristics with other scary demonic creatures in Greek mythology, including fauns and satyrs. This towering 7-foot-tall hairy creature is depicted as having bulging eyes, a whip-like tongue, pointed ears, and horns on top of his head. He carries a pitchfork, or more traditionally, a bundle of birch switches, to menace children as he travels through town on a pair of mismatched feet, one being a cloven hoof and other being a bear-like claw. Wayward children caught by Krampus were spanked, whipped, and even shackled to be spirited away in either a basket or a barrel to Krampus's lair. Once there, they receive further punishment until they repent. Scholars estimate that Krampus started appearing around the 13th century, if not earlier, perhaps in the 11th century, originating in southern Germany and Austria. The creature moved to other European countries such as Switzerland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and even the Alps villages of Italy, some with variations on the name and practice customs. For example, in Western Austria, Krampus tends to look like a giant sadistic teddy bear. In Western Germany, he actually arrives with Santa, sitting shotgun in the sleigh. In Southeastern Austria, the birch sticks used for his whip are painted gold and displayed year-round, which reminds kids of Krampus's impending arrival. Public celebrations on that night have many costumed Krampuses walking around the streets looking for people to beat. Alcohol is, of course, involved. Injuries in recent years have led to some reforms, such as the requiring of all Krampuses to wear numbers so they may be identified in case of overly violent behavior. Krampus may look like a devil or a wild alpine beast, depending on the material that are available to a Krampus costume. In modern times, people can spend as much as they like to become the best Krampus around. In the tradition is spreading beyond Europe. Many cities in America have their own Krampus night now, such as the Krampus Fest in Los Angeles. All right. So the next one I got on this list, I'm not even going to try to pronounce because I'm going to screw it up. Talk about the Icelandic Yule Cat or the Christmas Cat, which is an Icelandic word, and it's like 12 letters long, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce that damn word. So he's not a nice cat. In fact, he might actually eat you. This character is tied to an Icelandic tradition in which those who finished all their work on time received new clothes for Christmas, while those who were lazy did not. Although this is mainly a threat. To encourage children to work hard, parents told the tale of the Yule Cat, saying that he could tell who the lazy children were because they did not have nice new clothes on. And these children would be sacrificed to the Yule Cat. This reminder tends to spur children into doing their chores. A poem written about the cat ends with the suggestion that children help out the needy so they too can have protection of new clothing. It's no wonder that the Icelanders put it more in overtime at work than most Europeans. So the next one on the list here is Frau Perchata. The tale told in Germany and Austria sometimes features a witch named Frau Perchata, who hands out both rewards and punishment during the 12 days of Christmas. She is best known for her gruesome punishment of the sinful. She will rip out your internal organs and replace them with garbage. The ugly image of Perchata may show up in Christmas processions in Austria, somewhat like Krampus. Perchata's story is thought to have descended from a legendary alpine goddess of nature who tends the forest most of the year and deals with humans only during Christmas. In modern celebrations, Perchata or a close relation may show up in a procession during Fastnacht, the alpine festival right before Lent. There's also connections between Frau Perchata and an Italian witch, but the Italian witch isn't really a monster. She's ugly, but she's a good witch who leaves presents. So the next one we got here is Bell's Nickel. Now, Bell's Nickel is a male character from southwestern German lore who traveled to the United States and actually survives in Pennsylvania Dutch customs. He comes to children sometime before Christmas wearing tattered old clothes and raggedy fur. Bell's Nickel carries a switch to frighten children and candy to reward the good behavior. In modern visits, the switch is only used for noise and to warn children that they have to stay good before Christmas. Then all the children get candy if they are polite about it. The Bell's Nickel, the name Bell's Nickel is German for Belzen, which means to wallop, and nickel for St. Nicholas. And Ruklaus is a similar character for German folklore to dole out beatings to bad children, leaving St. Nicholas to reward good children with gifts. And then the next one we got here is Hans Trump. Hans Trump is another anti-Santa who hands out punishment to bad children in regions of France. The legend says that Trump was a real man, rich, greedy, and evil man. Maybe that's why his name is close to Trump, who worshipped Satan and was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. He was exiled into the forest where he preyed upon children, disguised as a scarecrow with straw jutting out from his clothing. He was about to eat one of the boys he captured when he was struck by lightning and killed. A punishment of his own from God. Still, he visits young children before Christmas dressed as a scarecrow to scare them into good behavior. So then the next one we got here, Paris Fouettard. So the French legend, whose name actually translates to Father Whipper, begins with an evil butcher who carved and ate children. He or his wife lured three small boys into his butcher shop. He killed them, chopped them, and salted them. St. Nicholas came to their rescue, resurrected the boys, and took custody of the butcher. The captive butcher became Paris Fouettard. He became St. Nicholas' servant, whose job it was to dispense punishment to bad children on St. Nicholas Day. So then the next one we have here is the Yule Lads. Now, the Yule Lads aren't really devilish or that mean. They're just little trolls that are not very nice to look at. The Yule Lads are 13 Icelandic trolls who have a name and distinct personality. In ancient times, they stole things and caused trouble around Christmas time. So they were used to scare children into behaving like the Yule Cat. However, the 19th century brought tales to the malevolent Norwegian figure of Santa Claus, who brought gifts to good children. The traditions became mingled until the formerly devilish lads became kind enough to leave gifts and shoes of children that were left out. only if they were good boys and girls, of course. So the reason why the Yule lads get a bad rap is because of their mother. Now, their mother, Grayla, so all the Yule lads answer to Grayla, who was their mother. She predates the Yule lads in Icelandic legend as an ogress who kidnaps, cooks, and eats children who don't obey their parents. She only became associated with Christmas in the 17th century when she was assigned to be the mother of the Yule lads. According to legends, Grayla had three different husbands and 72 children who all caused trouble, ranging from harmless mischief to murder. As if the household wasn't crowded enough, the Yule Cat also lives with Grayla. This ogress is so much of a troublemaker that the Onion blamed her in 2010 for the eruption of an Icelandic volcano. Alright, so here's one thing I was going to cover, but I didn't think I had enough time, but apparently I do, since I finished my notes, and I have time now. Since I am Legend 77 in the chat room, requested it, we're going to go over Black Pete. So the thing with Black Pete is, which is pretty hilarious, but I did have this story that I kept on the side just in case, because I thought about going over Black Pete, but I didn't know if I had time. And I didn't want to go over every goddamn thing about Christmas and Christmas lore and all that stuff, because that would take forever. I thought about going over the Wild Hunt and different things about Yule, and I figured I just didn't have enough time to cover everything, because there's a lot of stuff to cover. So I just picked out bits and pieces, and yeah, that's what you get. So as I'm sitting here looking on Google for something to talk about Black Pete, here is an interesting thing that's not really that old either. It's only from August. So apparently the UN fucking urges the Netherlands to stop portraying Black Pete. So the United Nations Committee has urged the Netherlands to get rid of Black Pete, who is a popular children's character who has long been portrayed in early winter by white people in blackface makeup, usually with exaggerated red lips and gold hoops in his ears. I don't know if this story actually tells you, or the thing with Black Pete is, he's a little kid who's a goddamn chimney sweep. He's black because he's cleaning out the fucking chimneys. People don't have chimney sweeps anymore. They don't clean out their own goddamn chimneys anymore. But back in, I don't know, the medieval days, back in the Middle Ages, little kids were the ones who did that kind of work because they could fit down a fucking chimney. Or in the fireplace and stuff. You got to clean that out sometimes. It's all full of soot and crap. And it's gross. And you got to clean that out. So you send a damn kid up there to do it. That's why he's black. He's not fucking blackface. He's not trying to look like a fucking African. He's black because he's goddamn doing work. Something black people don't know about. So anyway. So the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination wrote in a report issued Friday, which is late August, that the character of Black Pete is sometimes portrayed in a manner that reflects negative stereotypes on people of African descent and is experienced by many people of African descent as vestige of slavery. It is urged the Netherlands to actively promote the elimination of the racial stereotype. It is not a fucking racial stereotype. It's a goddamn little white kid who's cleaning goddamn chimneys. These goddamn black people are fucking triggered by this. I'm triggered by your goddamn stupidity and level of just idiocy. The Dutch government responded by dismissing the idea of the ban, but said it would promote a discussion, however, uncomfortable about racism. The Dutch are already reinventing the way they portray the controversial character. At schools of my own children, the Petes last year were orange. So they look like fucking Oompa Loompas. So instead of making them black, now they're going to make them orange. So they look like goddamn Oompa Loompas. So the figure of Black Pete accompanies St. Nicholas in December in parades in nearly every city and village, in almost always a white man in a red suit arrives on horseback while Pete, his servant, walks alongside distributing candy. Because fucking Black Pete is supposed to be a little kid. Black Pete is fodded in a pitched culture war within Dutch society with anti-racism activists denouncing the racial stereotypes and other insisting that the figure represents a harmless tradition according to which Pete's skin is darkened by soot from sliding down chimneys with gifts. Mr. Asher spoke carefully, saying he understood the hurt feelings on both sides, including those who fear they are losing their tradition. We must realize that changing an old tradition takes time, the minister said. Social media users engaged in a debate more unruly than uncomfortable in response to the UN report. On Twitter, critics call the tradition a disgrace. Others describe the UN reports as an example of racism against the Dutch. Well, I'm sure most of those people, especially the people in the United States who are pissing and moaning about Black Pete, don't know a fucking thing about Black Pete. They're going off of this crap they heard on Twitter or Facebook. That's where all they get. That's the only place they ever get their news. So they go, oh, Black Pete is this fucking white guy in blackface. No, it's not fucking blackface. It has nothing to do with fucking black people. Get over your goddamn selves, you assholes. Not everything is about you, and nobody's trying to appropriate your fucking culture. It's not about fucking black people. It has nothing to do with black people. All right, so where was I? So the emotional debate around this one character is part of a broader argument that limits about the limits of multiculturalism in Dutch society. There you go. There's the main point right there. Earlier this month, the upscale department store announced that the Pete character would now wear gold makeup. In 2013, the official city parade in Amsterdam, the largest city in the Netherlands, featured Pete without gold earrings. Like, how does that change anything? City officials said the changes would continue until the character was no longer cast as a racial caricature and eventually resembled someone who would climb through a chimney. He kind of does. Did you ever see it? Okay, I know nowadays we don't see kids going down a friggin' chimney. But those chimneys are dirty and they're gross and they're full of soot and ash and all kinds of crap. You're going to get covered in black stuff. In July, one of the country's main daily newspapers, the NRC Handelsblad, came under fire for using a racial epithet in review of three books on racism in the United States. So what, they said nigger because it said the word nigger in the book? I don't know what this has to do with Black Pete. For some reason, they just decided to throw that in there. Thank you, New York Times, for being a bunch of stupid Jews. So let's find something else on Black Pete. There isn't that much on Black Pete. He's kind of boring. That's why I didn't put it in here. There's not much to say, except now these social justice warriors are getting all bent out of shape. As long as the guy in blackface. Not fucking blackface, you morons. Why don't you learn about what the hell you're pissing about instead of just pissing about stuff just for the sake of fucking complaining about something? Because that's all it really is. They look for every damn thing, every cultural thing they can fucking just tear down. It doesn't matter what the reason is behind it or what it has to do with anything. They're just like, oh, this is racist just because I fucking say so. No, it's a reminder of slavery too, apparently. All right. There's nothing good. Let me check. Let's check Jewipedia. See what Jewipedia has to say. Oh, so the character first appeared in its current form in 1850 in some book. Oh, well, according to fucking Jewipedia, or maybe this is where they get their crap from, because I never heard this before. Traditionally, Black Pete is said to be black because he's a Moor from Spain. Those portraying Black Pete typically put on blackface, makeup, and colorful Renaissance attire, in addition to a curly wig, red lipstick, and earrings. In recent years, the character has become a subject of controversy. We just talked about that. So I never heard that he was supposed to be a Moor. That's the first time I ever heard that. Then again, I never really looked into it. I just always assumed. So you heard he was supposed to go down the damn chimney. But according to Wikipedia, they said he's a Moor. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe I got to look into that better. Anyways. Yeah, so I'm just rambling here. So I'm just kind of skimming through this. I don't know. For some reason, now they're going to the Wild Hunt. I don't know if that has to do with anything. Wait, now in that book. Damn it. I knew I should have looked into this better. But I think in that book, he was a Moor. But I think he was much older than this 1850 book that they brought up in the first place. Yeah. So in 1850, that's when that book came out, which, as they said before, is the more modern appearance of Black Pete. But Black Pete's been around forever. Yeah, so in that book, Black Pete is a Moor. But before that, he was not. That's where they got this crap from. Some idiot wrote a book, made Black Pete a black guy. Because he probably didn't know any better. Who is this guy? Oh, okay, so this guy is Dutch. So he should have known better. Or he's just making up a damn story. He's just writing a fictional friggin' book. Anyways, I'm rambling. I'm not making any sense. I'm trying to read this damn thing and tell you guys about it. But anyways, so I think I'll shut it down for tonight. I said about Black Pete what I wanted to say. And it doesn't matter if he's a black guy. He's not a black guy. Black Pete's not a black guy. He's a goddamn white kid who went down chimneys. That's why he's black. He's all dirty. Stop being a triggered asshole. Fucking it up for the rest of us. I'm going to play out the song. I got this song. It's pretty funny. I was looking for music to play on the show. And I found this song, which is a parody of a comedy song. So this is Grandma Got Molested at the Airport.
Grandma got molested at the airport. Flying home to our house Christmas Day. They groped her breast and manhandled her hoo-ha. They ought to be arrested, TSA. Her metal hip set the alarm off, so they had to pat her down. But they patted her so roughly that her Depends underwear fell to the ground. She never felt so violated, and when they ended their attack, there were glove marks on her buttocks and incriminating latex in her crack. Grandma got molested at the airport, flying home to our house Christmas Day. They groped her breast and manhandled her hoo-ha. They ought to be arrested, TSA. They made her take her wooden leg off and remove her purple wig. They confiscated all her prune juice as they rummaged through her luggage like a pig. Now Grandma's cherub-like demeanor had quickly turned into a funk. She saw them cupping Grandpa's balls and wiener, raised her cane and shouted out, "Don't touch his junk!" Grandma got molested at the airport, flying home to our house Christmas Day. They groped her breast and manhandled her hoo-ha. They ought to be arrested, TSA. Now Grandma's flight had left without her, and she was left in misery, holding her wig, her leg, her undergarment, and what was left of her civil liberty. So show the TSA your tatas. Let them grope your daughter and your son. If we fall in line and get stripped of our freedom, then we know that the terrorists have won. Grandma got molested at the airport, flying home to our house Christmas Day. They groped her breast and manhandled her hoo-ha. They ought to be arrested, TSA. Grandma girl got molested at the airport. Flying home to our house Christmas Day, they drove to Brest and manhandled her hoo-ha. They ought to be arrested, TSA.